There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 228. Going to ramp up some more fantasy baseball talk, and I got a special guest, a reoccurring guest. Find his work over at pitcherlist.com, Razzball, and just great work all over the Twitter, at @fantasy_Esquire. Dan Richards. Dan, how we doing, my friend?
I'm good, man. Thank you for that all-too-kind intro. Thank you again for having me back on, and yeah, I'm excited to talk some baseball. It's getting really boring waiting for the season to start. So this week's been kind of crazy with trades and non-tenders. So we got some good stuff to talk about.
Definitely. I thought we were going to be in trouble for news for this podcast since I talked about a lot of previous work a couple nights ago. And then the dominoes just kept falling and falling and falling. And I'm like, this is not the MLB hot stove we're used to, Dan. This is amazing. And I'm a big fan of it. I'm good with this every year if they want to do it this way. A couple little nuggets every day. I'm a big fan there. You mentioned it, and we don't have it on the outline, so we don't have to go deep on it at all. Just what's your thoughts in general? Doesn't it be a fantasy perspective, but it is a baseball discussion that's going to affect fantasy one way or another. All these non-tendered guys, and it's strictly financial. It's strictly dumb, but it's in the rules. How surprised are you with some of the names that got basically let go?
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty surprised to see guys like Michael Franco and other big name players just not, you know, re-signed. And it's going to be a thing where, you know, organizations are realizing that they can add players from their minor league levels up to the majors, and they don't need to pay their veterans anything. And they can pay the MLB minimum to the minor leaguers. And basically, in some instances, get similar value in terms of actual play on the field, especially those teams that aren't competitive. So it doesn't matter whether they, you know, they're tanking. So it doesn't matter whether they re-sign someone or not. And it's probably going to have a big impact on the CBA negotiations in a couple of years. I'm hoping there's no strike. I'm sure you are too, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. It's feeling like there's going to be one, unfortunately. But at the same time, it's like both sides have already acknowledged there's such a big issue that they're talking about ramping up talks way earlier than normal to try to avoid that, thank goodness. I'm usually a glasses half full type guy. I just have a really bad feeling because we've never seen these type the last few years with free agency and now these non-tendering deals. We haven't seen anything like this before. This is like kind of terrifying. But at the same time, a guy like Zach Wheeler gets paid today. So that was absolutely outstanding to see. We saw Moustakas and Grandal already get paid after kind of having to bet on themselves recently. Hopefully there's less betting on themselves going forward for other players. But Wheeler gets 5 years, $118 million to go play for the Philadelphia Phillies. Different park, obviously, than in New York. But we've seen Wheeler do it. 182 innings, 195 innings the last 2 years. Sub-4 ERAs. An xFIP of 406 last year, 381 the year before. He's been consistent the last 2 years after previous years of, you know, injuries and whatnot. Going over to Philadelphia is a little scary at times, but from a fantasy perspective, Dan, how do you feel with Zach Wheeler heading to Philadelphia, a division he's still very familiar with?
For fantasy, I think it doesn't change too much. In terms of just home run hitting, it's Citi Field was surprisingly bad for pitchers last year, so it might actually be an improvement for him. And we'll talk about that more later. But you know, win potential, like, they're both above average teams, the Mets and the Phillies. You know, he had a weird year last year where, if you remember, he was barely startable for about half the season, and he'd go out and he'd throw a decent game, and then he'd give up like 6 or 7 runs right after that. And his strikeout rate was about 26%. In the first half of last year, and then it dropped to about 20% in the second half when he was actually performing better and you could start him. So it's weird. Like, he may have gotten unlucky in the beginning and then lucky in the second half when he made a change. And he's obviously going to be a guy you're interested in on a good team, and he can pitch deep, and he'll probably give you a lot of innings. But you know, I like it more for the Phillies in real life than I think it matters for fantasy.
And that's a good way to put it. For real life, it makes that Phillies rotation so much better, obviously, with, you know, Jody Nola, maybe Arrieta finds a little semblance. He doesn't have to be the big guy now. He can be the third or the fourth option in that rotation. They got some other young arms they can play with. It does add the depth they need there, because the Braves keep getting better and better. We'll talk about them in a minute. But it's a very good real-life move. I'm with you. Like, I like Zach Wheeler. I thought he'd take a bigger step this last year. And you mentioned that he finished strong in the second half, which I like, which is good to see. But at the same time, it's like going to Philadelphia, where Zach Wheeler's probably going to go in drafts, you're going to want him to be a little better than he is. I'm not saying he was bad by any means, but I got your pitcher list ADPs up here. Like, right, he went 118 in a 12-team league. Is that too high for you?
No, I think that's fine. You know, it's a little – it's probably right around, if not a little later than when he went last year. And now he's basically put up two seasons that were very similar. So, you know, 118 sounds about right, because he's clearly got a ceiling. He's got four, maybe even five really good pitches. When he's on, you know, he can toe the rubber with the best of them. And I like the move for the Phillies a lot. I think they need it to remain competitive, like you said, against the Braves. And like you were also saying, there's no one else in that rotation that's any good besides Nola. So Arrieta is kind of a bust for them. And I don't know who else they're even throwing out there these days, like Vince Velasquez and Zach Eflin. They needed him. And for fantasy, I think he's fine. So I don't think a lot changes.
All right, let's go to those Braves. They've been very, very active to start the year. And usually it's been in the bullpen. Well, they went and got a starter. This past year, they went and got Dallas Keuchel midway through the year. They didn't want to wait too long this time. They went and got Cole Hamels. And it was pretty cool to hear there's a bunch of teams in on Cole Hamels. And Cole Hamels just wanted a one-year deal, which was very surprising. So 1 year, $18 million to go to the Atlanta Braves. That's cheaper than the qualifying offer, for crying out loud. So you can't really go wrong with this situation. And he was outstanding with the Cubs this last year. 3.81 ERA, 4.3 xFIP, a little sketch, but gave you reliable innings, got the job done on the mound. Doesn't have to be the ace anymore. You already have Soroka and Fried and company in Atlanta. Ballpark's definitely not as ideal as Wrigley Field, at least on a non-windy day. What's your thoughts on Cole Hamels with the Braves?
For a real baseball perspective, I really like it for the Braves. You know, they get a proven guy. He had over a 9 K per 9 last year, despite being 35 years old. So he's clearly, you know, figuring it out without velocity. And that has staying power, as we see with a guy like Zach Greinke. But the Braves don't really have to commit to him because they're only paying him for 1 year. So, you know, I mean, Hamels had that one down year in 2017 when we thought he was basically done. You know, his strikeout rate dropped, peripherals were ugly, but, you know, he started trading sinkers for four seamers, which is pretty common. And, you know, he went from a good team to a great team, a team that's on the rise. So his win potential definitely increases. You know, they just came off winning their division. They signed Will Smith, so their bullpen should be pretty strong. They already had a few big names in there. They got a great lineup. I mean, it's a nice landing spot for Hamels, and it's really just a durability question. He was very good last year for a long stretch until he got hurt, and then he came back and he wasn't really the same. So, you know, with a full healthy season, if he could throw like 180 innings, he could be really good for fantasy. A nice buy low.
Yeah, I agree. There could be some interesting there options there with Hamels. It's just kind of limit the damage in Atlanta, take advantage of some of the road ballparks, again, not Philly, but Miami, even with their fences in New York and whatnot, should help quite a bit there with Cole Hamels. But it is an interesting move. It's a great move for the Braves. It's a phenomenal move for the Braves. I was very like, okay, that made too much sense. Why are teams not doing stuff like this? This is what, you know, contenders should be trying to get as a veteran, and he needs eater that's going to, you know, for a reasonable deal. So it made a lot of sense there. The Angels are a team that probably could have used a Cole Hamels, but I think they're looking for a different Cole down the line here pretty soon. But made a trade for Dylan Bundy. And I've talked about him a lot towards the end of last year on this podcast and other shows. I've mentioned him from time to time in my DFS shows, talked about him once or twice in the offseason. I know Dylan Bundy's ugly. I get it. The overall peripheral stats are ugly, not him personally, but the stats. But the last like half of the year or so, you saw a different Dylan Bundy, a guy that used his slider a little more, some of his different pitch mixes. And he still had the occasional blip on the radar, but way, way more efficient starts than normal, way more quality starts than normal. And the home runs kind of dropped down a little bit. It was pretty impressive to watch the change with Dylan Bundy. And it's not going to hurt being out of Camden Yards. What's your thoughts on Bundy in 2020? Because I'm afraid with this move, his hype train might go too high, and I might not want to pay the price he's going to get to, but I do like the talent.
Going back to what you said before about the non-tenders, you know, it's kind of wild. Like, he was their best pitcher, you know, and they're getting rid of him. But that said, it's probably a good thing for his value. He'll go from a place where it's basically if not the best hitters parks in baseball. He's getting out of there. He's getting out of the AL East, going to the Angels, which is a much bigger stadium. Hopefully they can just fix him. Michael Ahedo for Pitcherlist wrote a great article this week on Dylan Bundy. And then of course he gets let go and traded. And if you read that article, he makes this interesting point where he looks at Bundy's game log and he sees that there are several games at the end of the season last year where he changed his four-seamer for a sinker, which is the opposite of what most pitchers are doing. But it helped him a lot because he's so home run prone. And that fastball that he normally throws, he just throws it middle and it gets smacked. So he clearly doesn't have good command of it. It's one of the worst pitches in baseball. It's got a negative 21.7 PVAL last year and a negative 40 over his career, which is horrible.
Oh, wow.
And the sinker actually had a positive PVAL last year. So if the Angels see what we see and they make some changes, there's something there. Like, there was a stretch a couple of years ago where he threw like six or seven starts in a row that were like incredible. And then he went out and gave up like six runs without recording an out. And that's, it's always a possibility with him, but if they fix the pitch mix a little bit, it's going to a better park. Like, he could be a nice like late round flyer in fantasy, or like a guy you pick up off the waiver wire after a month, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, this could be a sneaky move if they utilize him properly there. And it's amazing how many teams don't utilize these guys properly. I already know I saw Nick and Alex from the Pitcherlist, Nick Pollock, Alex Fast, were already kind of like bummed that Wheeler's going to Philadelphia because they don't utilize the high fastball and, you know, all these things like that. Well, we need more teams to figure out what works. And Eno Saris made a good comment after the Bundy trade. He said, imagine if they get Gerrit Cole. You'll have Cole, Heaney, Bundy, Canning, and Shohei Ohtani. That's a pretty solid starting five for Anaheim. So definitely something to keep in mind there. It's amazing just what one little move can do, couple prospects. Could be a nice situation there. Let's talk a couple Miami Marlins, a couple guys that got non-tendered. Actually, these guys didn't even get non-tendered. They just got DFA'd. So they didn't even get to – well, technically, I guess they were non-tendered. They just didn't get to wait till the finale like everybody else. They were just let go way earlier. And one is Johnny VR, a guy that in the fantasy industry is a polarizing individual because people don't believe the offensive hype. They believe he can run, but the power, the average, there's a lot of non-believers, and there's the other ones that love everything there is to love about Johnny VR. Well, the Marlins loved everything about Johnny VR. They're willing to pay him $9 to $10 million, unlike the Orioles. And they're going to put him in third base and the outfield to start the year. That was kind of interesting to me. It means guys like Nick Birdie, who people like a lot, aren't going to get as much playing time in the outfield. Ryan Anderson's got to play more outfield than third base. It's going to mess with some of those rotations. But let's just talk Johnny VR for now. Jonathan VR in Miami. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just wild to see the Orioles dump they're one of their best players, a 4-win player who's well worth $10 million.
Very good.
Yeah. You know, I think that he would have at least garnered some prospects worth $10 million at the trade deadline if they wanted to
That was my thought. It's like, you're not going to win this year. Why not let him play a couple months, see what he can do, and trade him?
My guess is the Marlins must think that whatever value in terms of attendance that he brings to the stadium, plus whatever they can trade him for at the trade deadline, is worth more than $10 million plus whatever they're giving the Orioles right now. So, maybe the Marlins see something the Orioles don't, or maybe the Orioles see something the Marlins don't. Maybe no team will really pay for him. I don't know, but it's from a fantasy perspective, it's a bit of a mixed bag. He played 162 games last season, and he needed every single last plate appearance to hit 24 home runs. So he's moving from an extreme hitter's park to the seventh worst in terms of turning barrels into home runs, which we'll talk about later. But the Marlins are, I heard they're bringing in some of their outfield walls. And he's got guaranteed playing time, which was not a given, considering he could have ended up somewhere else where he's just a utility role like he was a couple of years ago for the Brewers. So, he should get a lot of stolen base opportunities. He's probably not going to hit 24 home runs again, but, I would proceed with caution. I wouldn't be jumping on him in drafts. He could be the kind of guy that bottoms out really early or gets traded into a utility role halfway through the season.
It is tough with VR. I've always been a big VR fan at the right price. I took him in like the fourth round, I think, last year in 15 teamers. I know that might have been early for some, but I'll take it then. Right now he's going like, I've seen him go early to late third rounds, and I don't know if I can quite get there. It's going to be interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah,
it's a push, because the thing that made him work in Baltimore, like you mentioned, he gets that extra ballpark to help him hit with power. Miami, I don't care how much you move the fence, and the pictures showed like maybe 5 feet. They weren't like massive moves. Well, VR doesn't hit a bunch of 30-foot-plus home runs that go into the stands. Like, so let's just be real about the possibility of him just cranking them out of Miami. And then again, if he gets traded, maybe he goes to a team where he's platooning. So
exactly,
it's a tough deal. Tough deal with Jonathan VR. The other move the Marlins made is the Milwaukee Brewers got rid of Jesus Aguilar. Not got rid of him. They traded him to Tampa Bay last year. Tampa Bay got rid of Jesus Aguilar. He goes to Miami now. And this is an interesting job because they're saying he's going to be the everyday first baseman. Garrett Cooper will play the outfield. Again, they have a lot of young talent. They're just throwing in the outfield now instead of their normal positions. But what's your thoughts on Jesus Aguilar, who let a lot of people down last year? I was not a fan going into last year, but maybe a new change of scenery will help this man out.
Yeah, Marlins making moves. It's strange, because they already had Garrett Cooper at first base. So ESPN said they're going to platoon them. Garrett Cooper was pretty decent. He put up 1.3 F4 in about two-thirds of the season. So my guess is they maybe move him into the outfield and let Aguilar play first base. They're also both righties, so I don't understand how they would platoon them. My best guess is that they're betting on Aguilar breaking out. And then, like he hit 35 home runs in 2018, so maybe he could do that again and then trade him at the deadline for whatever he's worth. And it's a small investment. He's only costing them $2.5 million. But for fantasy, he is unlike VR, the kind of guy that can hit the ball really far into the stands. So it may not matter which park he's in. It's obviously difficult to hit home runs in Miami. It's not a great situation. Hopefully he has some playing time. My guess would be not. I'm not drafting him at all, and I'm going to assume no one is. And he's a guy you pick up if you see something in the first couple weeks.
Yeah, it's tough. He's a streaky hitter. ran hot a couple years ago, in my opinion. We saw more of what I feel is the reality last year. I even had people disagree with me last year. I kept saying, just drop him. You don't want him. It worked out last year. Everything can change. Guys can develop new hit tools. Who knows? I just don't see that developing in Miami, but you never know. So we'll see with Jesus Aguilar. But you kind of hinted at barrels and ballpark factors and everything, and I wanted to get you on a couple weeks ago. I had some things take place where I couldn't get you on because it wouldn't have worked out so well. But we have you now, so let's talk about it, because I had you on last year talking about a home run metric that you were working on. This kind of works with it, I think, a little more and takes it even deeper and gives a different angle to it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it's barrels and ballpark factors. And what I love about it is barrels is a thing I use a ton. I know a lot of people use a ton. I love Baseball Savant. I can go down Baseball Savant rabbit holes for days, just clicking on things, looking at the cool little bars, red things line up, then take deeper dives, so on and so forth. And that's how a lot of us just kind of get lost. But you factored in ballpark factors to go with it. So let's start out with just, we'll keep it with the simple part, the barrels. What were you noticing with, say, barrels, batted ball events, stuff like that, that kind of started making you look at that, and then we'll switch into the ballpark factors?
Yeah. So a barrel is a ball that's hit between, for those who don't know, 26 and 30 degrees. So a nice home run angle, at least 98 miles per hour. And then the launch angle band expands as the ball is hit harder. So just looking at 2019 data and isolating balls in play, so, you know, ignoring plate appearances that end in strikeouts and walks, things like that, barrels explained about 78% of the variance in all home runs. So for balls in play, home runs were explained by barrels about 78% of the time. Then 82% of all home runs were the product of barrels. So, you know, the vast majority of home runs hit in MLB were also barrels. They were also these balls hit between 26 and 30 degrees, at least 90 miles per hour. So given that strong relationship, it makes sense to use barrels as a proxy for home run hitting and a way to measure park factors. So I used basically home runs as a percentage of barrels hit, and league wide, the average was 59.6% of barrels became home runs. So on average for every barrel hit, there's 0.596 chance of a home run produced. And then if barrels were becoming home runs at a greater rate than that in a given venue, then I labeled that venue as a hitter's park and vice versa. But I think that a helpful way to conceptualize it is looking at home runs as a percentage of total barrels in a venue. Mm-hmm. So that standardizes the competition across ballparks.
I like that a lot. Like I'm looking at your chart now, and you mentioned Eno Saris. I actually had Eno on last year when he came out with his park factor, because it was very surprising, a couple of ballparks that stood out on there that even some of yours are surprising. We'll talk about those. The home run per barrel percentage makes a ton of sense, how you broke it down. You know, if 82% of barrels are home runs and all these different correlating factors. So you do how many home runs in each ballpark, how many barrels in that ballpark, I'm assuming, gives your home run per barrels. The park factor column, was that just where did you get the park factor?
So I took the standard deviation of the set, so the different ballparks, and then I calculated Z scores, which are they basically measure the amount of spread from the mean, again, the standard deviation. So if the mean is 59.6% of barrels become home runs league wide, then a Z score of 1, which is about Minute Maid Park. That means that Minute Maid Park is one full standard deviation away from the mean. So at Minute Maid Park, 68% of barrels became home runs, whereas the league average was 59.6%. So that's a full standard deviation away from the mean, and it goes in the reverse as well. So Target Field was one standard deviation away from the mean by being a 51% conversion rate. And that's a likely pitcher's park.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So when we're looking at it, like the more heavy pitcher parks like Target Field, Tropicana, Kauffman, Comerica, Oracle, Fenway always surprises people because they picture the green monster, but they forget like right center field and right. That's just a deep alley back there. Center field, right field, right center. Exactly. I mean, they forget about that portion of the ballpark. When we're thinking pitcher's parks, because those ones kind of all make sense. You got Marlins Park, You got Chase. I'm assuming that factors in the humidor now. You got PNC, Nationals, Bush, Wrigley, Oakland. Was there any real surprises on that side of things?
Yeah, I mean, seeing that Oakland had basically a league average home run to barrel conversion rate, barrel to home run conversion rate, was surprising because it's huge, and we think of Oakland as this vast pitcher's park where it's very hard to hit a home run. Now, one caveat I want to give is that some of this can be influenced. So it's only 2019 data, and some of it can be influenced by the actual barrels that are hit themselves. Like, let me back up for 1 second. Looking at home runs as a percentage of total barrels standardizes the competition across ballparks. So if you just look at a home runs hit, if you wanted to do this and just look at the total home runs hit in a park and say, the most home runs were hit in Baltimore, therefore Baltimore is the best place to hit home runs, you wouldn't be controlling for competition. That's the point of this. That's why we use home runs as a percentage of barrels. So that says, okay, let's see how many home runs came as a result of these extremely well hit balls, irrespective of how many amazing hitters or terrible pitchers played in the parks. That said, not all barrels are created equal. So, the guys in Oakland, the home players, the divisional players who go to play there, if they are hitting their barrels on average a lot harder than some other players, then it's possible that they're converting barrels into home runs at a greater rate that this is not accounting for. So this can change next year. It's just what happened this past year in terms of barrels becoming home runs. Maybe next year Oakland is more of a pitcher's park because Matt Olson gets hurt, and then the barrels that are hit there aren't hit as hard and they aren't converted into home runs as frequently. Another one more quick caveat is that, and I actually got berated by Todd Zola for this, but these park factors are just for home run hitting. They're not general park factors. So
gotcha. Good point.
Certain places are actual pitchers parks and maybe lower down on this list, or actual hitters parks and maybe higher up on this list, because run scoring is still very high there. For example, at Coors Field, but hitting home runs on barrels is hard to do there. Or harder to do there.
A question that's not technically on your page here. You mentioned that the barrels aren't created equal because some are hit harder than others. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I've asked many people, and I either don't get an answer or I don't get an answer I can understand. And I don't know if there is a correct answer or not. I just want to get your opinion on it. With that bouncy ball we saw last year, how much of a factor do you think that increased barrels or stuff along those lines? Because I tried to get answers from guys of, do you think this is why they saw, certain hitters saw such jumps on things, but other ones didn't. It was kind of a weird dynamic. I hope I'm not blabbering too much, but I'm trying to rationalize what the bouncy ball did to the, I guess, quality of contact. I know it makes the ball go farther, but the quality of contact, does that make sense?
Yeah, I would say that if you ran a Statcast search for the average barrel rate, or even just the total barrels that were hit last year, that would be higher than in years prior. The average exit velocity is probably also higher. The average exit velocity on fly balls is also probably higher. I mean, I'm not doing that right now, so I can't tell you for sure, but just given that there were more home runs hit, I would think that the ball was actually hit harder. And if that's because the ball is different, it's possible, but it's not like the barrel rate is going to stay the same and home runs are going to go up across the league. I think the barrel rate would move with it.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. The target field one actually stands out to me because that's one of those where we saw the Twins hit so many home runs last year, but maybe they just did a lot of damage on the road. That's an interesting one. When we drop up down to the hitters ballparks more so, the top, you'll say seven are over one standard deviation. You mentioned Minute Maid Park, Angel Stadium, City Field might surprise a lot of people, Miller Park, Oriole Park, Dodger Stadium, Great American Small Park. So like Dodger Stadium, City Field, Angel Stadium, not really known as big pitchers parks or home run parks, but they stood out a lot here. Is there anything specific you might have saw when looking at those?
One thing to note is that this list doesn't account for non-barreled home runs. So,
gotcha.
So like 19% of all home runs hit last year were not barreled. So if you did account for those, and I'm not doing that, but if you did account for them, Minute Maid Park would be number one. If you just looked at home runs hit over barrels as opposed to home runs hit on barrels, the list would change a little bit. I didn't do that because I don't think that non-barreling home runs is a repeatable skill. So even if a ballpark did move up for a certain reason, I'm not sure it would stay that way the next year because the players that made it move up might not be able to sustain that. That said, you know, I think it's interesting. Eno's article had Oriole Park and Dodger Stadium also really high up. I think he may have found that Dodger Stadium was number one or Oriole Park was number one, right up there with Great American Ballpark. I think what this does tell you is that guys that may not have the best exit velocity but play in those parks and have been hitting home runs at surprising rates may continue to do so. You know, one guy that comes to mind is Eugenio Suarez, who plays in Cincinnati. You know, he's very likely to continue hitting home runs, even though his exit velocity isn't great. But he had an 80% home run to barrel conversion rate, which is way higher than the 59% league average, but he plays in Great American Ballpark and the rate there is about 74%. So he really didn't outpace his home park rate by that much. You know, Angel Stadium, you had a guy, Tommy La Stella, who barreled the ball 9 times. And guess what? He hit a home run on every single one of those barrels there. So I was
efficient.
It's very efficient. And I was giving him a lot of crap in my predicted home runs articles because he was not hitting barrels, but he was hitting home runs and the formula didn't like him for that reason, but it's possible he continues to do so. Or he's just inflating the ballpark factor here. And maybe Angel Stadium isn't that hitter friendly and he's just the reason why. I don't know, but Citi Field is definitely surprising, like you said. Mm-hmm. And one example of that is Pete Alonso, who hit 23 of his 53 home runs on just 26 barrels.
Wow.
Right. That's an 88.5 home run to barrel conversion rate. That's very, very high, well above the league average of about 60%. So that may not continue, you know, or it might. I don't know. But that's the point, is that some of these parks were surprising and they helped their hitters a little more than you might think.
How going forward, do you have any plans to keep, you know, maybe tinkering with this? Or how do you think we as fantasy players should utilize this kind of tool?
Here's how I think it's most helpful. First of all, I think it's more helpful for you evaluating hitters than pitchers because giving up home runs is not a category, whereas home runs is a category in fantasy baseball, or seeded home runs rather. But I think that you should use these in conjunction with your Statcast analysis and your Fangraphs analysis. So if you're looking at a player, like Pete Alonso is a good example. I know his exit velocity is high, but let's assume it wasn't as high. And he had converted all of these. He hit a lot of home runs and we didn't expect it. Or actually, Eugenio Suarez is a better example. He did hit a lot more home runs than we expected. You know that he plays in Great American Ballpark half the time and that he is likely to outperform his exit velocity, even if it's not an average launch angle, even if they're not excellent. Whereas if we're looking at a guy like JD Martinez, who lost like 10 home runs last year, and we're wondering why, you know, I mean, he's playing in Fenway and it is the hardest place in baseball to convert a home run into a barrel into a home run. So his conversion rate at home might stay low. Those home runs might not come back. It's just, even if his exit velocity is really high, it's just a good way to use, to evaluate players' peripherals in context.
Well, let's have fun with it then. Like Mike Moustakas leaves Miller Park, which was almost a 70% home run per barrel. And he's going to Great American Small Park now, which is almost 75%. I know you tweeted out something about his overlay of home runs. How big of a factor do you think that should be for fantasy? How much should we, you know, maybe try to increase his potential home runs?
I'm going to say quite a bit. It's not because Miller Park was a great place to begin with, but think of it relative to Kauffman when he was hitting about 30 home runs. That was the home run to barrel conversion rate is 46% at Kauffman Stadium last year. The home run to barrel conversion rate at Great American Ballpark is 74%. So it's far more likely that on his barrels, he's going to earn home runs next year. And it's so, yeah, like you said, I tweeted out that overlay of his fly balls and line drives at Great American Ballpark. Also all of his fly balls and line drives last year, but like smacked onto Great American Ballpark. And I counted 64 home runs there. Obviously, even if he does go to the Reds like he did, he's not going to play every single game there. But it's still, it's telling that, you know, if he hit 40 next year, I wouldn't be shocked, you know, or 45. Yeah.
No, that's awesome because, yeah, obviously he's not going to play every game there, but still he's playing half his games there now instead of playing nine. So it's quite an increase in production that might be coming Moose's way, which has me very excited as a longtime Moose fan. But any closing thoughts? I like the idea of you know, comparing, especially guys changing locations and whatnot. Any closing thoughts on the work you've done on barrels and ballpark factors?
One thing is that, you know, I'd like to incorporate ballparks that boost non-barreled home runs. So like pulled fly balls that go like 335 feet and become a home run at Yankee Stadium or Minute Maid Park. That is not accounted for here. I mean, obviously a lot of pulled fly balls are barrels, so those are accounted for. But the ones that aren't and become home runs, those 19% of all home runs that are not barreled, I think there is some kind of way to incorporate it into here. I just don't know how. I'm a little worried that I'm not sure it's repeatable. But at the same token, like Alex Bregman and Yuli Gurriel went crazy last year, and a big part of that was because they were pulling fly balls into the Crawford boxes at Minute Maid Park. And so, you know, if you looked at this, you would say, well, you know, they're in a hitter's park, but it's not one of the best hitter's parks. Well, it might be for them specifically, and that's not really accounted for here. So if I could incorporate it in some way, I'd like to look into that beyond just adding them in, because I don't think that they're as valuable as regular barrels. But other than that, yeah, I just think you should just use these in conjunction with your normal analysis and how you evaluate players in context.
Sweet. Can't wait to see where it keeps going. It's always fun checking out these new tools to use as we get more and more data, and smart people like yourself dig into it for the rest of us to utilize it in a more efficient manner. Let's look at the pitcherless mock drafts. I know the writers of pitcherless, like yourself, did three mock drafts, and you've documented those and talked about those. And then there's three expert mock drafts. I was a part of one of them. And so there are 12 team mocks, and now we have six drafts and an ADP that Smata put together, which is pretty awesome. And this is kind of a free-flowing situation here. We're just going to kind of talk about things, maybe some guys that stand out at weird prices. But just for fun, the top 12 picks, so the first round of the draft, on average, went Trout, Acuna, Yelich. Let me just get your opinion on this, because it's a hot topic already this year. How do you do your top three picks?
I would do them just like that. Although I have seen a lot of drafts where Acuna is first and Yelich is second and then Trout is third. And I personally, like, Mike Trout every single year puts up crazy numbers and you're guaranteed to get that. Whereas Christian Yelich has been a bit of a progression and Ronald Acuna just is breaking out, you know, in about a year and a half's time. So I love the large sample of Trout, and we just know he's the best hitter in baseball. So I feel like banking that in the first round is smart. And Yelich is coming off of injury too. So I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm a big Acuna fan for the steals. I love Trout. Like, if anybody wants Trout number one, I'm not going to argue with them ever. I just don't think he's going to run that much anymore, and Acuna will. And that's just that's a big thing for me. That's the only difference. I really don't care. Like, I've told people, if I can pick my spot in the draft, just give me the third pick. I'll take whichever one no one else takes, and then I'll get my next pick before the rest of them. So that's the way I look at it. I won't argue with anybody. I prefer Acuna over Trout, and then Yelich's like a pretty firm three for me. But yeah. I could see the argument for all three of them.
Yep. With the high ground ball rate, you know, Yelich could fall in terms of power production, and I'm not sure he's going to continue stealing at that rate either. So I agree. He is the solid third, in my opinion.
And then it gets fun for the rest of the first round. You have Betts, Bellinger, Lindor, Story, Turner. First pitcher off the board, Gerrit Cole, Bregman, Soto, Arenado. Were you surprised there weren't more pitchers in the first round?
Well, in pitcher list mock drafts, you would think so. But I think he's a little bit better than the 2, 3, and 4 pitchers. And so I think he deserves to be in a tier of his own. I think he's the most dominant pitcher in baseball. I personally do not like drafting pitchers early. I especially don't like using pitchers with my first pick. So am I surprised? I'm more surprised than I am. I think it's the correct decision. Like, I think it's right to not take a pitcher with your first pick. And so I'm happy to see that the results sort of fell that way. But I would say, yeah, I am a little surprised.
Yeah, I'm surprised by it because it seems like more and more are going that way. My whole goal in a draft is to get two of the, I like to say, like top 20 pitchers if I can by the end of round 4 or 5 at the latest. So usually I find myself taking them in 3 and 4. I get a couple bats early, couple pitchers, and go from there. That's usually my repertoire. Just kind of depends on the draft. But I've been seeing more and more guys take pitchers early, so it kind of stood out to me in this draft. But we see it in the second round between picks 13 and 24. We got Verlander, DeGrom, Scherzer, Buehler. They all went one way or another. What's your take? It's a hot topic on Twitter these days. Are you a big believer in Walker Buehler potentially even moving higher up in the starting pitcher rankings by season's end?
Oh, I don't know. I draft for floor early and ceiling late. So I'll shoot my shots later and I'll just take guys that I am confident I can bank production and guys who've done it for a number of years. Walker Buehler is obviously an amazing pitcher. But there are innings concerns, there are injury concerns, there are Dodgeritis concerns, which is something that Nick likes to say about the Dodgers moving their pitchers on and off the injured list, which they do because they have a lot of pitchers, so they can do that. I don't know why you would personally, I don't know why you would take such a risk because the payoff is really no better than the other pitchers that you just listed. Whereas the floor is a lot lower. So like at best, he's going to be like, you know, who else did you say? DeGrom and Verlander. But at worst, he could pitch like 130 innings and it might not all even be that good if he's injured for some of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you get into round 3, Jordan Alvarez goes at pick 28. Are you a believer? I know you like to get floor early and I'm with you, but some people are just loving them some Jordan. He went as high as pick 17 and as low as pick 35. Are you do you understand the concept of taking him early, which some people love to do for some reason?
Yeah, I do, because if he plays to his full game, to his full season pace, it's like 40 something home runs, and you know, he hit for over 300 average last year, so you know, he'd basically be what you want out of JD Martinez, who is taken at the end of the first round, or right in the beginning of the second round, or he's kind of like what you're hoping for out of Nolan Arenado. So I get why you would take him early. Again, I wouldn't take him that early because it's a ceiling floor game for me. And it's basically just betting. There's such a small sample of him being that successful. And we saw him sort of fall apart a little bit in the playoffs. So, I don't think it's wrong to take him, in the third round, I think, or the late second round. Like, I think that's probably where he's going to go. And there may even be a point where I take him, but I'm not going to be the guy drafting him at 17th overall.
We already talked about Jonathan Villar probably going high. He's going up pick 41 in this 12-teamer. Adalberto Mondesi went pick 42. Are you comfortable taking a guy like Mondesi that early?
Oh, my God. I love Adalberto Mondesi. Yes, I'm extremely comfortable, and I think he should go earlier. Like, his stolen base rate, and I don't have it in front of me, but the rate at which he steals per plate appearance is – not only the best in the major leagues, but it's like far and away the best in the major leagues. Like he runs so often. And so as long as he's healthy, even when he didn't even play a full season last year and he was still great, he still stole like 45 bases. Like he stole as many bases as Trey Turner basically, but he didn't play a full season. So you know what you can get with him, and you're getting him three rounds after Trey Turner. So I think he was a steal last year and he's going at the exact same price as he did last year, even though he showed he's clearly for real. And also, he actually had a decent barrel rate, and my predicted home runs metric says he should have had more than like 6 or whatever home runs he had. He should have had a lot more, and he was one of the unluckiest players in baseball. So, you know, you got a little power and you got a ton of speed. He should be at least a third round pick, if not earlier. Like, I would take him before I would take Jordan Alvarez.
Okay, that's one question. I was going to say, you probably take him over VR. Other shortstops, did you take him over Xander Bogaerts?
Yes.
Gleyber Torres?
Definitely.
Javi Baez.
Yeah. And I think it's closer with Baez. We do bold predictions before every season. And last year, my bold prediction was that Mondesi would out earn Baez. And he did. And even though he didn't play a full season, he did. He was a lot better. And so I get why, because Baez can be more of a five category contributor, and like Mondesi's probably never going to hit like 300, but they're very similar contact guys. Like they both swing a ton. Baez is going to hit a few more home runs and he plays in a friendlier lineup, but you know, those stolen bases are becoming really hard to find. And I think Mondesi's potential to steal 50 or 60 bases could make him a first round pick the following year.
Last one, Mondesi or Fernando Tatis Jr.?
Oh, that's tough. I would probably take Tatis. Mm-hmm.
They're going almost 20 picks apart.
Yeah, so Tatis is going earlier, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, it's hard because my head says Mondesi, whereas it's really hard to see a guy within that much earlier of an ADP and to buck the trend. I'll write a bold prediction saying he'll out earn Tatis. And I know Tatis's strikeout rate was really high and his BABIP was like 400. So he's an easy candidate for regression, but he also steals, which gives him a nice floor. So it's, you know, I think Tatis is probably the right pick, especially considering that everybody else thinks so, but I like Mondesi a lot.
Yeah. The Tatis one's going to be a fun one for fantasy analysts throughout the season, because he's going to be going so high because people love him so much. And if that thing falls apart, it's going to be quite the onslaught out there, because people have planted their flags already. So it'll be real interesting to see how that plays out.
If your second round pick flounders, you're screwed, you know? And I was right. His strikeout rate is 29.6% last year. That's way above league average. That's really high. And his BABIP was 410. So you really... you're getting a lot of luck on BABIP and very little plate discipline. It's hard to hit over 300 like that. It's really hard. It's not sustainable. So my guess is he falls apart at least in batting average, if not also in power, and he may not be worth what you pay for him on draft day.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Right after Mondesi, Clayton Kershaw, who doesn't have the innings like he usually does, but they've been very, very efficient. And then Shohei Ohtani goes right after him. And we have to just pretend he's starting pitcher only, which you're going to get one start a week, basically, from Ohtani. Are you comfortable taking Kershaw? You're probably more comfortable taking Kershaw. But are you comfortable taking Kershaw and a starting pitching only Ohtani before guys like Corbin, Castillo, Nola, Severino, Morton, and company?
I probably wouldn't take Kershaw. I would just wait for those guys you just listed. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the same goes for Ohtani, especially. So in this ADP, you're saying he's only pitching eligible and he went this high?
That's the way I am under the influence when we did this draft. He's starting pitching eligible and he went pick 44. Maybe I am mistaken here, because I would be shocked to see him go this early. But that's that's how it's listed on the sheet.
So, yeah, I agree. That's way too early if he's just starting pitching eligible. I did see that Kershaw's strikeout rate improved from 23.3% to 31.1%. And yes, I tweeted this out today, from the first half to the second half in 2019, which is nice. And, you know, he's basically like a quality start and win machine last year. So you couldn't really count on him to be great. But do I think he's going to be better than Corey Kluber and Patrick Corbin and Zach Greinke and other guys who are like pretty similar and also really good? I don't feel comfortable saying that. Like, if you didn't give me their ADPs and you just told me their names in a vacuum, I'm not sure I would have said Clayton Kershaw was the best of the bunch. So I would probably just wait for those other pitchers like Severino.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. Going after a slew of pitchers here, Giancarlo Stanton is going to pick 47. Giancarlo Stanton used to be a back end of the first round pick time and time again, but apparently this last season made enough drafters in these drafts be like, nope, done. Given in the third expert mocks, he went as high as pick 30. So that was pretty telling. All the pitcherless mocks, 55, 55, 57. What's your take on Giancarlo? Because this is a guy, I know he's got 40, maybe even 50 home run power. I hate saying injury prone, but by now it's getting crazy.
I'm getting some serious 2017 fantasy baseball draft vibes here. Like, He had so many injuries before that, and he let people down, and all these analysts were like, well, you know, he's probably only going to give you 40 home runs anyway and like a 270 batting average. So why would you take him in the first round? Like, why are we taking him in the first round? So he falls to like the fourth round, and I took him everywhere. And then he hit 59 home runs.
Yep.
59. So nobody does that. So I I get why he fell again. The exact same thing happened in 2018. He kind of disappointed. And then in 2019, he didn't play. But this is a guy with like first round ceiling. And I mean, clearly from his MVP season, if he shows it, he's a huge value at this price. I'll probably be in on him at this price. The only hesitation I have is that home runs are ubiquitous and like all hitters are hitting them now. So he's not as valuable as he was 2 years ago, even if he does hit on his value. But this is a good enough price where I feel comfortable taking him.
All right. Just in a vacuum, I'm going to list some of these young names that kind of all go together. Like Vlad Guerrero Jr. is pick 58. You got Keston Hira at 67. Eloy Jimenez at 68. And even guys like Bo Bichette at 75. They're going earlier than a lot of talented, you know, I guess they're talented too, but a lot of more like veteran aged players. Are you good with taking some of these guys so early? Like Jimenez, I'm good with. The other ones, I don't know if I'm 100% on board with. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I feel pretty similarly. Like I kind of like the gains Eloy made last year in power and strikeout rate. I mean, he was really coming into form at the end of the year. So if, you know, you took him around pick 70 or whatever, I think that's fine. And there's a little potential for value there. The others, I don't feel comfortable drafting that early. I didn't feel comfortable drafting Vlad Jr. that early last year. I never drafted him. Bo Bichette is not fast, and I think he had a poor stolen base conversion rate. So they may not let him run. And you know, who was the other? It was those two, Eloy
and Keston Hira.
And Keston Hira had like exactly like Fernando Tatis Jr. He had an inflated BABIP and a really high strikeout rate. So I don't think he's going to hit 300 again. You know, all three of those guys are going before, yeah, a 31% strikeout rate and a 402 BABIP, and he hit 303. That's not gonna, it just doesn't happen, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's small sample, so that's why he was able to do it, but it's probably not gonna be able to do it again. And he doesn't do enough outside of that. He's not like a big power hitter or anything. Same thing with Bichette. So those are not guys I would take in the top 100. Vlad, I could see closer to the end of the top 100, but like you can get a guy like Jose Abreu, whose ADP mm-hmm. in these drafts was 89, who consistently hits like 285, 300 with 30 plus home runs and 90 runs and 120 RBI. Like you can get that later than all these guys, and you can bank that production in a good lineup. And there are a lot of other examples too. I don't see why you would take any of these guys. You know, I don't see what they give you that he doesn't, or other similar veterans that are way more likely to give you value, like Nelson Cruz, than them.
Jose Abreu never gets the love he deserves. I love the consistency he brings to your lineup. Makes that draft pick so easy because you just slot him in and you know what you're getting. It's a beautiful thing. So I'm with you there on guys like that. These young kids could be good and all, and they might be the make or break picks. Who knows? But I find it hard to take those gambles. A gamble that hasn't paid off really well in recent years, but the stuff continues to be so intriguing. The 23rd starting pitcher off the board at pick 69 is Noah Syndergaard. Are you a Syndergaard believer, or are you just done with him?
I think that's fine. I think that value is the first time where I felt comfortable taking him. I didn't personally in the draft that I participated in, but if you were going at pick 69, I think that's fine relative to the prior years when he was like pick 38 or pick 30, you know, and when he had come off that like 180 inning pitch season, maybe like 2017 or 16, where he was just like awesome. And then he just totally fell apart and got hurt, and then he fell apart again last year. And I think that the pieces are all there, and the Mets just need to like put it together so that he's throwing the right pitches in the right places. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen, but the risk that it doesn't is reflected in his draft price for the first time, as opposed to prior years where we had not much of a sample and we were betting on him because he throws 100 miles per hour. Whereas now it's okay, I think, because he's going later.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Now it's okay. He's going later. Hopefully it pans out one of these days. As you go through the ADP, were there anything that kind of stood out to you? Because we could keep going player by player, but I was just wondering, on your opinion, were there any kind of standout picks, or are you still evaluating the ADP?
Ben Palmer wrote a great article going through this. I'll give some of the highlights that I took away from his article, where he goes through the full ADP and he gives you surprises, undervalued and overvalued players. And the surprises, the most surprising to me was DJ LeMahieu with a high of 23. I think that's insane. I do not think you should draft DJ LeMahieu 23rd overall. I'm sure you agree. And I'm a Yankee fan, so there's no bias. Let's see. In the overvalued players, Victor Robles stood out. I think that he is someone who hits for very, very little power. As Ben noted, a 23% Statcast hard hit rate, which is bottom 4% of the major leagues. I'm not convinced that he can even hit 255 like he did last year. And so basically you're kind of paying for like bad Malik Smith but with fewer stolen bases, because he only had 28 last year. And for some reason he's being drafted on average at 71st overall. And then one more, two more, Ben combined them. So he's tricked me on this podcast live. But he combined Andrew McCutchen and Justin Upton, who had ADPs of 220 and 247.
Those are steals. Absolute steals.
I completely agree. Both of them. I even liked McCutchen last year when he was like pick 120, and I liked Upton last year when he was like pick 100.
Mm-hmm.
Those are consistent guys. McCutchen's going to hit for a decent average, steal 15, 20 bases, hit 20, 25 home runs, get a bunch of runs in RBI. Upton's going to hit even more home runs like he always does. Even if his exit velocity fell last year, which I'm not sure it did, that would be because of injury and for no other reason. He's only 32 years old. So, Justin Upton, one of the most consistent power hitters in the game, with a full healthy offseason, he could be an excellent value at ADP 246.8.
I love the point you made on Upton, especially because we talked about Abreu being like the back of the baseball card consistent. Upton is that guy. He was hurt almost all of last season. So I literally, with the track record of a guy like Upton, I just throw last season out the window. I don't even care about last season. He's already come out and said he's having a regular offseason. He'll be ready for spring training. Like, he's already telling you he's fine, which is all I need to hear. So I'm a big fan of that. You know, you put a healthy Trout with him, maybe a healthy Ohtani in the lineup. That's a whole different ballpark. A whole different ball game with those guys. So big, big fan of that Justin Upton comment. And I'm with you. I was all over Andrew McCutchen last year. I was pumped when he went to Philadelphia. I was happy with his draft cost. Now he's going to be this much cheaper. It's like, okay, I dig it. let's do this thing. So, and these are a couple names that are very good to know, because in a lot of your deeper leagues, five outfielder leagues, and that could have affected this because it was a three outfielder draft. We got to keep that in mind, but you still had two utilities. So who knows? Like, even a guy, I'd rather have McCutchen and Upton, but if you're talking outfield, you got AJ Pollock going about 226. He's got the injury concerns, but when he's healthy, he's outstanding. Another guy that has injury concerns once in a while, but if you're looking for late speed in the outfield, Adam Eaton's going 250. It's all these kind of veteran guys that you can almost pencil in what they're going to do, kind of got pushed down because a lot of these young kids got pushed up. So, like, okay, a guy that gets no respect at pick 293, Sin Soo Choo. You want to talk consistent? He's consistent. So, I don't know. It's interesting. That's why I kind of just want to get your opinion, because I could rabbit hole this thing for a long time and just start, you know, nitpicking everything. But that's what the listeners need to go to pitcherlist.com and go check out all that good stuff. Speaking of pitcherlist.com, Dan, before we call it a night, why don't you let everybody know where they can find you and what you have out there and what you might be working on?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at @fantasy_esquire. It's a terrible pun on the fact that I'm a lawyer. I might do DF Esquire because I kind of like that, but I don't play that much DFS. I know you do. The pun is better that way. Working on, I guess, I did a fun thing with comparing two players but not giving you their names. And I know that's sort of played out at this point, but like a name brand guy and then a more generic guy who's going a lot later in drafts, and just sort of identifying the flaw and why one should be going much later and one should be going much earlier. And it was JD Davis and Chris Bryant. And people were receptive to it. So I might continue that kind of trend with, and the thesis is that I like JD Davis more than Chris Bryant, but, spoiler alert.
I don't disagree with you. Don't disagree.
And I might do it with relievers and starting pitchers, because it was a lot of fun to write it. And yeah, we'll see where it goes. I got to get more stuff out for Razzball too. But yeah, so I really do want to thank you for having me on, Bubba. It's been a lot of fun. Hopefully we can do this again soon.
We will definitely do it again. I love having you on, talking baseball with you. You cover the gamut. You can make very smart things sound like I can understand them. So it's always fun chatting with you on that. And anytime we can line it up, I am always down to talk some baseball. But everybody, go check him out on Twitter @fantasy_esquire. Dan's a great follow and a great guy. So go give him a follow and check it all out. But until next time, this was Benched with Bubba, episode 228, talking barrels, ballpark factors, ADPs, and much, much more. Catch you guys later.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.